Good morning. May it please the Court. Jess Kranick on behalf of Appellant Mr. Thaddeus Speed. Mr. Speed is a 34-year-old African-American male. Unless this Court grants him relief in this case, he's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. Mr. Speed was convicted of 3 counts of crack cocaine trafficking, and he was sentenced to mandatory minimum term of life without parole. He received that term for 2 reasons. First, because the jury found him responsible for crack sales performed by his co-defendant, Tony Cunningham. And second, because he was sentenced under the 1986 version of the crack statute, shortly before the Fair Sentencing Act of 2010 changed the penalties. Now, on both fronts, Mr. Speed's conviction and sentence are reversible. First, because under Supreme Court precedent, Mr. Speed is entitled to the benefit of a change in the law while his case was pending on direct appeal. And second,
as I'm sure you're well aware, Mr. Kranick, this court has ruled now a number of times that it's the date of the conduct that triggers the applicability of the Fair Sentencing Act. The civil cases that you cite on the, law applies at the time of the case are not subject to the same savings statute. So maybe you could tell me why the savings statute doesn't override cases like Bradley and the other ones you cite.
Certainly, Your Honor. And just to be clear, at the outset, we are certainly aware of this Court's precedents with respect to the Fair Sentencing Act at this point. There are several. Because of those precedents, we advised the Court, and I hope we did this clearly in the briefs, that a number of the arguments were being presented for preservation purposes. That said, we did advance several arguments regarding the Fair Sentencing Act that this Court has not previously addressed. The primary argument there is asking this Court to address a conflict in Supreme Court precedent. This is a difficult issue involving competing lines of case law. In other words, cases such as Mr. Speed's fall into a gap where it's unclear what the presumption should be with respect to a change in the law while the case is pending on direct appeal.
If I understand you, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it seemed to me that in a sense you are saying that the concept of retroactivity itself comes in a couple of flavors, and when one says, for purposes of the savings statute, something is retroactive, it might mean the date of the conduct, or it might mean just something is not retroactive. It applies only to things that reached the end of the direct review process as of the date of the new statute. Now, this wouldn't be the first time that there are a couple of different meanings of the notion of finality or the notion of retroactivity, but I haven't seen any court of appeals adopt what I think your concept is for the Fair Sentencing Act, which is that, yes, it's prospective only, but prospective means anything that was still in the direct line of appeal.
Your Honor, the precedents of the Supreme Court and of this Court establish a fundamental distinction between the way that retroactivity is viewed with respect to collateral review cases and with respect to direct appeal cases.
Well, sure. There are a lot of criminal procedure areas where that's true.
Correct. And specifically, what I'm referring to is the rule that an interim change in the penal law is presumed to apply to cases pending on direct appeal. Now, that rule stems from Justice Marshall's 1801 decision in U.S. versus Schooner Peggy. And the rule announced there was that courts are to apply the law generally, in effect at the time they rule, unless the legislature states otherwise or unless manifest injustice will result.
But is that compatible with the savings statute? I mean, Congress can modify that rule.
Right. And the Supreme Court has described the savings statute over and over as a modification of the common law rule. Oh, there we are.
That's correct, Your Honor. The point that I'd like to offer with respect to that is that the Savings Clause has existed on the books since 1871. The Supreme Court's jurisprudence in this area has grown up alongside the Savings Clause. And the jurisprudence that we refer to in our brief has been applied again and again in the civil and in the criminal context.
The jurisprudence you're referring to in your brief has to deal with judicial changes in the law. And what the Supreme Court says when it announces a new legal rule is that this new rule has actually been the law all along, but we just didn't realize it earlier. And that has implications for what class of cases it applies to. No one is arguing that the Fair Sentencing Act has been the law all along and we just didn't realize it earlier. There's a fundamental difference in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence between judicial decisions and legislative decisions. And we've got a legislative decision. Now, why should we pay any attention to the judicial decision cases and not look at cases like Landgraf, which say that changing the consequence of an act makes it retroactive? That would be perfectly clear if what this new law had done was increase the penalties for crack cocaine. You would say that's retroactive because, in fact, it would violate the ex post facto law. It's equally retroactive to reduce the penalties for completed acts.
Certainly, Your Honor. The distinction we're asking this court to draw and the conflict we're asking it to address is based on a rule that's been announced by the Supreme Court in a variety of settings, not exclusively with respect to judicial decisions. For example, in Bradley versus Richmond, the court addressed a change in the law based on a statute, the amendment of a statute. And what the court noted there is that in its history, it had held that an interim change in the law, whether based on a statutory decision, judicial or constitutional, would be applied to a case pending on direct
yes,
appeal.
That argument was made in Landgraf and lost 9-0. Right? You might want to deal with Landgraf if you're going to make this style of argument. That was the very argument that increasing the penalties for racial discrimination, where the discrimination preceded the legislation but the lawsuit came after the legislation, that changing the penalties was not retroactive. Mm-hmm. Right? And the litigant relied on Bradley for that proposition. And the justices rejected it 9-0. Now, why should we view it differently now?
For a couple reasons, Your Honor. The primary case that has been relied upon by the government here is the case of Warden versus Marrero. And I point the court to that case because the dissent in Marrero specifically flagged this issue, noting that the saving statute should be construed as narrowly as possible.
If you want to discuss Landgraf, this is your opportunity. Marrero came 20 years before Landgraf.
Yes, Your Honor. With respect to the Marrero case, and you know, to address your question, following Marrero, where the dissent specifically noted concern with respect to the way the majority's decision would apply had that case been in direct review, the court followed up on its jurisprudence in cases of Griffith and Teague. And what the court noted there is that there is a fundamental difference between direct and collateral review, and that there has been a distinction in its jurisprudence for a particular reason. That reason is twofold. The first is that with respect to defendants who are in the direct pipeline, judicial pipeline on direct appeal, the court wants to make sure that defendants who are situated similarly procedurally receive equal treatment. The second is that defendants who are on collateral review are in a fundamentally different procedural posture. And the rule makes sense, because if the rule were otherwise, and the presumption was different with respect to collateral review, you would have a defendant whose conviction became final 20 years ago now consistently coming back to court to challenge the bases of his underlying decision. So drawing the line at that point is appropriate. Your Honor, I see that I'm eating into my rebuttal time, so with that, I will respectfully ask the court to consider the distinctions with respect to collateral and direct review, and with respect to that issue, to rule that Mr. Speed's amount of time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Hartzler.
Thanks. You got it right here? Thank you. Good morning, Your Honor. Joe Hartzler of the United States. The court appears to have addressed the questions that I was going to, or the points that I was going to make about the various cases that are relied upon by my opponent, the civil cases. One involves a Batson challenge, another involves attorney's fees, but I don't think they cite any criminal case. I agree that Landgraf should resolve the case on the savings statute. So I'm prepared to answer questions about any other issue, but it sounds like the points that I was going to make are already understood by the court.
Let me just ask you one question about the conspiracy. It seems that the government was charging a cocaine conspiracy, but the evidence with regard to Mr. Speed seems to relate exclusively to marijuana. So did you fail to prove the conspiracy that you charged?
No. The conspiracy that was charged related to crack cocaine, and the distributions, the first three distributions, were charges, overt acts in the conspiracy. The
and those are the ones that Mr. Speed wasn't there for. It was just Cunningham.
Well, he wasn't there at the hand-to-hand transaction. For the second and the third of the transaction, he was there as the driver to take Mr. Cunningham away, and Mr. Cunningham testified that Mr. Speed provided that crack cocaine, fronted it to him, and that he had paid Mr. Speed for the crack cocaine immediately after. So there's pretty strong evidence that Mr. Speed and Mr. Cunningham were engaged in a conspiracy to distribute the crack cocaine. You can see how it evolved, too. The first transaction, Cunningham met with the undercover agents at a mall in Bourbonnais, and Mr. Speed was no place in sight. And then as the amounts of money and the amount of drugs increased, then Mr. Speed accompanied him on the second transaction. And then for the third transaction, which was a very sizable amount of crack cocaine and a large amount of money, Mr. Speed was there as well with yet even another person. So,
and that's the one that sort of blows apart. I mean, you know, it really seems like the government got this exactly wrong in that Mr. Cunningham seems to, you know, be the older of the two people, the one who was the much more active dealer. Mr. Speed is younger. It's a pretty thin conspiracy, it seems to me. You have some talk of fronting, I'll give you that, but that's not in itself enough. I mean, our cases have drawn a distinction between credit transactions and actual fronting.
I think you misunderstood me with the third transaction. There are three distributions of crack cocaine. The first one Mr. Speed did not accompany. That's the one that takes place at the mall.
Right.
Okay. And then there are two others in September after
right.
that.
Right. And then there's number four and five that he four comes along and
four and five are the ones
marijuana.
That are recorded. They're talking about marijuana. And the fifth meeting is when he's arrested and has crack cocaine in his possession. So we're really talking about the first three as being part of the conspiracy. And in terms of the thinness of the evidence, of course, there is Cunningham that testified. And then you recall in that October 12th recorded conversation, Mr. Speed acknowledges that the 63 grams of crack that was distributed on the previous occasion was his crack cocaine. He was responsible for that. So we have confirmation in the recorded conversation on, I'm forgetful of the day, I think it's October 12th.
Well, he doesn't quite say that, but he uses the number 63, so you could infer, perhaps.
Well, he uses the number 63,
he has bought 63s from me for like... is what he says. Last
you're saying he doesn't say 63 grams of crack cocaine. I agree with that. Right.
Yeah,
right. And then on his cross-examination at trial, you recall, I mean, I thought he hurt himself at trial by testifying and saying when he was asked, isn't 63 a street slang, meaning 63 grams of crack cocaine? And he said it could be a 63 Impala.
Right. No, he said, I remember that.
So, I mean, I think that if you compare...
Well, he didn't admit it anyway, so...
Well, not only did he not admit it, but he made it an implausible explanation of a variety of things. He said, for example, that Mr. Cunningham had never, he'd known him all his life, yes. Had he ever been to your house? No, he had never been there. Cunningham, of course, had testified that he was there every day to pick up, the 3 days to pick up the crack cocaine. And I also want to point out that, bear in mind, in the conspiracy cases, there are these various factors that, of course, the court looks at. One of them is fronting, but it's also this mutual reliance, and you realize that it's Mr. Speed who provides the transportation. I mean, he's the one that carries Cunningham away from the second of the and the third transaction. I'm not suggesting it is an overwhelming case of a cocaine conspiracy, but it's it's a pretty strong case for the crack cocaine conspiracy with Cunningham's testimony and with the corroboration from the recorded conversation in the first meeting in October And he's at the scene, not just coincidentally, on the second and third transaction. I mean, he's there. He didn't just happen to be there because he wanted to buy a soda pop at that place, as he said in his testimony.
But he's nearby. He's not part of the direct transaction.
But that's very common for the dealer to try to insulate himself, or the supplier to try to insulate himself from the... That's what I was trying to suggest earlier. He's not even at the first transaction, but that's because it's a small amount of money. And then his involvement becomes increasing as we move along, and more money and more drugs are at stake, which is pretty common. And as trust builds with the undercover agents, as he becomes to believe that this is not law enforcement and they're not going to get busted, he ultimately meets with them.
Okay.
I hope that answered your questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hartzler. Anything further, Ms. Counsel?
All right,
Mr. Cranick? No, you have about 30 seconds left. You're not legally obliged to use it.
But may, since we didn't have the opportunity to address the conspiracy during my initial argument, I'd like to just address a couple of points regarding what opposing counsel said. First, he said that the transactions evolved. I'd like to point out that in the record, Speed's account of these events has been consistent all along. He became involved in these events when the government agents asked Cunningham whether Cunningham wanted to buy marijuana. It's at that point that Mr. Speed became directly involved. He was only directly involved with the two failed marijuana transactions. Opposing counsel also talked about Mr. Speed's statements, the recorded statements on October 10th. I'd like to point the court to those statements, to the similar recordings on November 13th, when Speed was asked point blank whether Cunningham had been running crack for him in the prior drug transactions, to which he said no, Cunningham was not his middleman. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Mr. Cranich, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.